Our scripture lesson this morning is taken from the book of Daniel, the second chapter. Daniel chapter 2, beginning with verse 1 and reading through verse 23. Hear now the word of God. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered the Chaldeans, The word from me is sure. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation. The king answered, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is sure that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king, There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and none can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious, and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went forth that the wise men were to be slain, and they sought Daniel and his companions to slay them. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's servant, the king's captain, Why is the decree of the king so severe? Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. And Daniel went in and besought the king to appoint him a time that he might show to the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy of God, of the God of heaven, concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel said, Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and mysterious things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for thou hast given me wisdom and strength, and hast now made known to me what we asked of thee, for thou hast made known to us the king's matter. May the Lord bless to our heart this reading of his holy word. It's a curious thing in the book of Daniel, especially in these opening chapters, that when God sends a revelation in the form of a dream or a vision, he does it to the king and not to Daniel. This story is, of course, about Daniel and about his relations with the court and the power of God displayed through Daniel. But we should not lose sight of the fact that although God is dealing with particular individuals, such as the king or Daniel and his companions, the message that he sends is not only for them. The message that he sends is for his people, and he's dealing throughout with his people Israel. Daniel is a book full of most dramatic stories. It's a fascinating book to read, and we get a lot of Sunday school material out of the book of Daniel. But we ought not to lose sight of the fact that God is doing a much larger work through what happens in these various occasions and dramatic instances. He's doing a much larger work than work in the hearts of a couple of men here or there. Even though he's working in the hearts of kings, he's still doing a much larger work than that. He's changing the nature of a whole people. It's an observed fact, been noted for a great many years, that the whole nature of the Jewish people radically changed after their Babylonian captivity. That as, whereas before they were often given to worshiping idols, they were always leaving the true God and falling off into various forms of polytheism, after Babylon they never did again. And I think that believing in the sovereignty of God, we have to decide that that was part of God's plan in the whole thing. And if that was part of God's plan, then we can see his hand in all of these events as they take place, and we can see him accomplishing that end even in this particular instance. Because what we have here at base and at root in this story that we've just read is a contest in which God shows himself to be infinitely superior to all the gods of the Babylonians. Now you remember, of course, that this is not the first time that God has shown himself to be superior to the heathen gods of the nations round about. God made his superiority to the gods of Egypt abundantly plain before he took his people out of Egypt. God made his superiority to the gods which the people of Canaan worshipped abundantly clear in the lives of the prophets. And you remember that dramatic encounter with the priests of Baal and how they were utterly unable to call down the fire of God. And this story here is, I think, a continuation of that same general theme in which God is displaying his infinite superiority over all of those beings that men are wont to call God and to worship. This chapter ends up, as you may know or as you may read later, with Nebuchadnezzar giving praise to God as the God of gods and the Lord of kings and so on, as one who is exalted above all other gods. He recognizes that God has done something here to show his measureless superiority over other gods. And this is part of his design and plan in all of these events. Now, there is, I think, a reason why God begins with the king, besides the fact that he wants to make things as dramatic and as high level as possible, give it a high profile, as people would call it now, and all of that sort of thing. There is another reason why he begins his revelations in these chapters with the king. And that is probably because this king in particular has been instrumental in the downfall of the kingdom of God on earth. In other words, he has been conducting a mopping up operation on the kingdom of Israel, carrying them away into captivity. And now, as a visible kingdom, the kingdom of God on earth in Israel is virtually extinct. The church, the temple, the worship of God is ruined. Its power on earth is dissipated. And we see the triumph of a secular kingdom all of the visions which God gives to the king are visions of warning and doom, and this one in particular is as though it were a warning directly to him, don't put too much stock in the kingdoms of this world, though they be magnificent, though they be very powerful. There is coming a kingdom not of this world, which shall destroy all other kingdoms and shall endure forever. Now that was a message which the king needed to hear, but it was also a message which the people of God needed to hear. They needed to have their hopes restored. They needed to have their heart strengthened. And God was doing that in this fashion. He was sending a message to them that all of this was in the plan and purpose of God, that better and more glorious times for his people were coming, and that in the meantime, nothing was out of control, because he was the God of heaven and of earth. And they ought not to go around thinking that if they worship this God or that God, they'd be better taken care of. But rather, he, as the Lord of heaven and earth, had all things at his hand, and the other gods of the nations were not to be given even the time of day. Now, to get down to the particular circumstances of the story, it's a very interesting one, and there's a great deal that probably needs to be commented on. I will not comment on any length about the obvious problem in chapter 2, verse 1, which is that he says this is the second year of Nebuchadnezzar. And anyone who's read the first chapter and can do some simple arithmetic knows that there's a problem here, because it says that King Nebuchadnezzar came and sacked Jerusalem, and he appointed these young men to do Chaldean studies for 3 years, and they finished their exams, and here now it is the second year of his reign. Now, there are a variety of ways in which those figures can be reconciled, and we simply do not have the historical data to know which is which. We do not know whether he was actually king when he sacked Jerusalem. The author may have been speaking proleptically. He may have been referring to King Nebuchadnezzar simply to single him out from other Nebuchadnezzars that one might think of, but the way we would say George Washington when he was a young man threw a silver dollar over the Potomac. Well, he wasn't president. We don't say he was president when he threw the dollar over, but we could refer to him as President Washington having done that. But he was not president when he did it. We don't know if that was the case. We don't know if it's simply a matter of a different way of counting or reckoning years. It may be that the first year of his being king was the year of his accession to the throne, and also the first year in which the men started their 3 years study. The Jews often referred to a thing as being a year when it was only a part of a year. Now, we do that too. We talk about a school year. A lot of people here are thinking about school years. Well, you know, a school year is not a year. A school year at best is 10 months, or worse, depending on your point of view. Actually, it's a rare school year in which you go more than about 180 days, which is only half a year. So it's not really a year, and the Jews often talked in that fashion. So there may be an explanation to be found there. But if we knew more about it, we would know how to reconcile it properly. What I can say is this is really a mark not of the falseness of the book of Daniel, but a mark of its genuineness. This kind of casual statement, this kind of tossing off of numbers, which are apparently in conflict, is a mark of the genuineness. Daniel and those for whom he wrote would have known the facts of the case, and it would have been no mystery to them, and he would never have thought to sit down, now, it got to be the second year on this account, and spell it out for us. But if he were drawing up this years after the event supposedly occurred, he was making it up out of his own head, and he went back to proofread it, he would notice that there's a problem here with these numbers. And he would say, oh, I better rub that out and make that the fourth year of Nebuchadnezzar, or something of that sort. So this is really a mark of the genuineness of the book. In any case, a vision comes to Nebuchadnezzar, and he is greatly troubled by it. Perhaps it was repeated several times, we don't know, but it was certainly a very vivid kind of a dream or a vision. And Nebuchadnezzar was troubled not only because the vision or the dream was unusual, it didn't have any relationship to his normal experiences or thoughts, it was pressed upon him and his heart was troubled to know what the meaning of it was. And so he went to his court counselors, to the wise men of the kingdom, to ask them to explain it. Now, there are commentators that I have read who said that he acted very cruelly in what he did. Well, I'm not so sure. He acted cruelly, no doubt, as an Eastern despot was wont to act. But I think you have to understand the nature of the situation that evidently pertained and why he was so severe. And it would be a little more understandable to you. The people that he called in to explain his dream, he knew were very glib at explaining dreams. They specialized in that sort of thing. I don't know if you've ever met, I never have actually met, I don't think, a fortune teller, but I've never read about one who was actually at a loss to tell anybody's fortune. They do that sort of thing. It doesn't matter whether or not it has any relationship to facts, you see. They just do it. These people were in the business of explaining dreams. Now, they had different means for going about it. They had different occult arts that they practiced, so they fell into different classifications. But they were all, no doubt, wont to explain dreams. They might have looked at the stars, they might have looked at tea leaves, or they might have looked at the entrails of a slain goat. There were lots of nasty ways to tell fortunes and dreams, but they were all experts at the art. Not only that, but the king knew from long experience that they were wont to give different interpretations. Now, that's not simply a fact of life when you're dealing with fortune tellers and mystics of various sorts. It's a fact of life of court life. A king always has a lot of advisors who are ready with all kinds of free advice. And the advice usually ranges the entire spectrum of the possible. And beyond sometimes, no doubt. And he knew that if he went and told them his dream, he would get 1,100 explanations and he still would be no better off. So these were people with whom he had a very strained kind of a relationship. They fed off him. He supported them out of the king's treasury. He needed them for advice because he realized, as every wise person realizes, that to gather advice makes, in the general, for a good decision. But he also knew that they were not entirely to be trusted as having his best interests or the truths at heart. And because he was very troubled about this particular dream, he thought of a way by which he could ensure himself that when he heard the interpretation, he would know it was the truth. And so he says, "Tell me the dream, and then I'll know that when you tell me the interpretation, it's the truth." If you can tell a dream, if you can find out by your occult arts, by your magic, by your sorcery, by your enchantments, by whatever means at your disposal, if you can find out what the dream is, then I'll know that you're telling me the truth when you tell me the interpretation. Now, of course, they were appalled to hear this. They had never heard of such a thing being done in all their experience. But it was not an utterly unreasonable request. Though they protested, "These things are known only to the gods, and the gods don't walk with men." In other words, we're not gods, we're just the servants of the gods, and we can't be expected to know. The king was not fooled thereby. Because he knew that in every previous occasion, when he had asked for advice, they didn't just say, "This is our advice." They didn't say previously, this is our interpretation of the dream. They said, our God has shown us this is the truth. And he was simply saying, if your God is able to show you the interpretation, let him show you the dream, and then we'll both be convinced. And this is not an unreasonable kind of a requirement. The fact that it's not unreasonable is shown that later on Daniel does exactly this very thing. It's unreasonable only to those who are unable to do it. The ungodly always judge all men. We all tend to judge all men, but the ungodly especially judge all men by their own limitations. The ungodly never think that a person is changed by conversion to Christ from being a wretched sinner to being a saint of God. They don't think that's possible because it's far into their own experience. And they will discount every story told them of such a change until it's forced upon them to acknowledge. These magicians didn't think this sort of thing was possible because it wasn't possible for them. So the decree went out to kill all the wise men of whatever sort or stripe. If they were fell under the general broad category of wise men or counselor to the king, off with their heads. Said literally, I will cut your limbs from each other. I will dismember you. That's what he was about to do to Daniel and his friends. So Daniel, you've read the story, procured of the king some time with the promise of bringing him an interpretation, and he goes and he prays with his friends, and God shows him the vision, and he goes and tells the king the dream and the interpretation, and the king is convinced. Now you'll notice that this is a very instructive story about several things. It's instructive about God and the supernatural in general. Here's a contest which the king sees clearly is not simply a contest between advisors to the king. It's a test of the reality of their religion. Whether or not their God is able to meet the test. Now, what is the reality behind idol worship? If there is any reality behind idol worship, if the heathen religion in question is not simply superstition, then Paul tells us the reality, when there is reality there, is demonic. So we can assume, I think, that there was some reality in some of these magic rites. Some of these were shaman. They were witch doctors. They were practitioners of the occult arts. Some of them were fakes, as many of them are today. Some of them, however, were doubtless in touch with demonic powers. Now, if the devil understood what was at stake in this matter, what does this story teach us about the devil? Well, what this story teaches us about the devil is that he's far more limited than you and I often think. Now, it's not surprising that the devil would not be able to think of the true interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, because presuming that God had given this as a revelation of his plans and purposes, the secret of what it taught would be his alone. But on the other hand, surely the devil would have been able to make up some interpretation if he had known the dream. Well, where did the knowledge of the dream lie? The knowledge of the dream lay not in the hands of the eternal God in the heavens. The knowledge of the details of the dream lay in the mind of Nebuchadnezzar. I don't think there's any real doubt that Nebuchadnezzar had this dream on his mind night and day. It troubled him. It puzzled him. His mind was always wandering off to think about it. He ruminated on it. It haunted him. There's a hint that the magicians and sorcerers understood this, and King Nebuchadnezzar accuses them of wanting to draw out the time that he would give them in the hopes that either he would forget about it, the dream would lose its cutting edge and cease to trouble him, or else he would let slip to someone what the dream consisted of, and they'd be able to pick up the pieces of it and make some kind of plausible interpretation. He says as much in his accusations of them. So he had this on his mind. Why didn't the devil know it then? Because I think we have here proof that the devil cannot simply read everybody's mind. If the devil were able to read all that was in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, he would have known what the dream was. Knowing what the dream was, if the devil is real and any of these magicians were actually in contact with him by demonic powers, he would have been able to tell them enough about the dream so they could have made a plausible stab at interpreting it. Now, I think that shows us something of the limitation of the devil himself. He is present in only one place, one time. He can't be everywhere. Maybe he was simply out of the kingdom of Babylon at the time and didn't have time to get back when he got the word. I don't know. But he was not able to discover the facts in the case, though they lay evidently upon the surface of the mind of Nebuchadnezzar. So not only is the devil and all of the false gods presented to and worshipped by the people of Babylon unable to do this simple thing, they're certainly unable to guide the course of history and nations, which God is revealing in the dream. He alone is able to do. He is the God of all time. But here's a contest between God and the devil in which the devil is badly shown up. Another thing which we need to take, I think, very pointed account of is the way in which Daniel dealt with this emergency. We noticed before that Daniel was not a person who was unnecessarily disruptive or provocative. And here again, point is made that when he spoke to the captain of the guard sent out to kill all the wise men, he did so with wisdom, discretion, prudently. And he conducted himself in such a way that he was able to gain access to the king, to make his promise to reveal the matter if given time. And then he went back to his companions and they had a prayer meeting. Daniel was a prophet of God. Daniel, we're told in the first chapter of this book, had discernment, had knowledge over all dreams and visions. Now, that did not mean that he was automatically able to understand the meaning of this dream or of any dream or vision, but it meant, I think, that this was not the first dream or vision he'd come across. It was not the first time God had enabled him to interpret dreams when those dreams came from God and had meaning. If they didn't come from God, they didn't have meaning. Perhaps when he was told that he had knowledge or discernment about dreams or visions, what is meant primarily is that he had the ability to tell which were genuine revelations of God and which were not. If so, he would be able to know that if this were a genuine revelation from the true and the living God and had a meaning, then he is a servant of God, having been given discernment and knowledge concerning dreams and visions. God might very well be planning to use to reveal this matter to the king, but he still had to go and pray that God would give him the matter. And even though he was a prophet of God, and even though he was a very wise man, and even though he had these gifts, he prayed, and his companions prayed with him. And if anything, this ought to teach us that we who are far less gifted servants of God than Daniel was in his worst day need to pray. Need to pray constantly and fervently and unitedly for those things which threaten the people of God. And of course, it ought to give us hope that God, hearing our prayers, will be favorably disposed in his answer, as he was in this case. They pled, as all Christians surely do, for mercy. They didn't go to God and they say, we demand to have what is our due and right because Daniel has been given this gift of discernment of dreams and visions. They didn't demand anything from God. They went and begged from God mercy from his gracious hand, and God was pleased to give them mercy, as God may be pleased to give us mercy, as God may be pleased to give Babcock mercy, as God may be pleased to give any one of us mercy when we cry out to him for our personal and family needs. So God made the matter known to Daniel. And Daniel's heart was immediately lifted up in thanksgiving to God. And I want you to notice just a couple of things about this great paean of praise with which Daniel addresses his God after God makes known the dream and its interpretation. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. Now, what he's saying here has reference to the content of the dream. The content of the dream, you recall, was that of the great colossus, the image of four different sorts of material that was smashed by a stone that came out of a mountain, and which stone itself grew and grew until it was vast in size. Now, what the dream meant was that there would be four successive kingdoms to be replaced in the end by the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, what he's saying here is that the God whom he worshipped, the God who had sent this dream, was the God of history, the God who directs history, who channels all the affairs of men and nations. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings and so on. That's what he means. The other day after the news, some more news came on. And they were interviewing a fellow who had founded the Apple Computer Company and now has more money than he knows what to do with. And so, having a few million lying about and not knowing what to do with it, he decided to have a rock concert and a technical extravaganza in California. And they were interviewing this fellow about his personal beliefs and whether he would be disappointed if he didn't get all his money back, if he lost money and so on. And he seems to have a very easy come, easy go kind of an attitude, whether he dropped 6 or 8 million here or there. And he made some mention of, after all, things being directed by a force. And the interviewer asked him what he meant by the force. Well, he says, you know, things don't just happen. There has to be a force behind things that makes things move. Now, he obviously had no knowledge of a personal God, but he did have that sort of rudimentary Greek notion of a prime mover, that events follow, that things move, and if things move, there has to be something that moves them. Now, Daniel is saying that's something that moves things, that's something that guides history, that's something that shapes the universe, that's something that raises kings and puts them down. That something is someone. Not blind fate, not irrational force, not the selection of the fittest, the survival of the fittest, you see, but that something is the eternal God of the universe, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Joseph, who does things, who moves things, and who does it according to his all-wise plan. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and mysterious things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for thou hast given me wisdom and strength, and hast made known to me what we asked of thee, for thou hast made known to us the king's matter. And he includes his companions in this prayer. But I want you to notice that one verse, 22. It may have to do simply with the gift of prophecy. A lot of commentators think that. I am not so sure. I think the terms here are broader than with that which would apply to the gift of prophecy. Daniel is speaking in sweeping, epical, universal terms. God, being the fountain of all wisdom and knowledge, who gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding, reveals all those things which are dark and deep and hidden from the mind of men. Now that might simply, as I say, refer to the gift of prophecy, that he reveals all those things which lie beyond the possibility of mankind discovering, because they're in the realm of the supernatural. They're in the realm of the thoughts and plans and designs of the eternal God. And surely that is what God does. And surely that is where all prophecy that is true prophecy comes from. But you know, that's where all knowledge, which is true knowledge, comes from as well. And that's where all wisdom, which is true wisdom, comes from. I don't know the answer to the question, but a lot of people have asked it. Where do thoughts come from? Are thoughts merely random electrical sparks set off in your brain by something? Do thoughts have a prior existence somewhere? Do good thoughts, sound knowledge, really originate in the mind of God? There is evidence historically, I think, that knowledge is not only inseparably linked to religion and especially fundamental to Christianity, but I think there is evidence historically that God has given great gifts of knowledge to his church and through his church to the world. Many of the great names of science, many of the great names in the discovery of things, had a Christian worldview. We've remarked before on the Christian notions of Christopher Columbus, how that his own name, Cristoforo, the Christ bearer, he took to be an indication that he was chosen and appointed by the providence of God to be the bearer of the name of Christ to heathen kingdoms. And that, and not the lust for gold, was the driving force that drove him to secure those ships and to set out. Oh, he had to bring home something, or to promise to bring home something to pay his royal patrons for the trouble and the expense of outfitting him, but his burning zeal was to carry the cause of Christ to those who were without Christ. And names in science, from Galileo to Newton to all manner of others, had a Christian foundation to their thinking. In our own day, when we look around And we see, for instance, what the world follows in the way of knowledge. I don't know what the last count was, but J. Adams gave something approaching 300 different schools of counseling. That is, 300 different schemes for helping people by counseling. An enormous amount of that depends on how you assess people. If you're going to counsel somebody, you've got to have a theory of what a person is and how he works. In other words, you've got to have a doctrine of man. If you're not a Christian, you're going to go wrong, you see, at your very foundation on what a man is and how he works and how he is to be helped. It's no wonder there are so many theories of counseling, and it's no wonder that they don't do a great deal of good. They don't know what they're working with, let alone how to change them.